and people report hearing a scream for help. People tried to help him, but were shot at. Five other people from the neighborhood were wounded.
There's enough resentment, purely pride and nationalistic sovereignty terms, to fuel a resistance movement. So no doubt about it, it's the most dangerous place in the Middle East and the world to be working as a journalist today.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Tuesday, August 19th, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. A suicide attacker set off a truck bomb today outside the hotel housing the UN headquarters. According to U.S. officials, at least 20 U.N. workers and Iraqis were killed, including the chief U.N. official in Iraq, and 100 others were wounded. Sergio Vieira de Melo, a 55-year-old veteran Brazilian diplomat who was nearing the end of his four-month mission, was in his office when the explosion ripped through the building about 4:30 p.m. and was trapped in the rubble. We'll have a full report from Baghdad in a moment. But in other news, a suicide bomber blew himself up today on a packed bus on a main thoroughfare in Jerusalem, killing at least 20 people, according to Israel Army Radio. The militant Islamic Jihad group claimed responsibility in a call to the Lebanese TV station Al-Manar. The attack killed three children and wounded at least 100 others. Attorney General John Ashcroft defended the Patriot Act today, saying the anti-terrorism measure passed by Congress after the September 11th attacks has been key to the nation's efforts to thwart attacks against Americans. In a speech to the conservative-leaning think tank American Enterprise Institute, Ashcroft sought to counter critics who say the act gives law enforcement unnecessary and overreaching powers that threaten the privacy rights of innocent people. A bomb planted in a vehicle outside UN headquarters in Baghdad exploded this afternoon, wounding some 100 UN officers and civilians and killing 18, including Sergio Vieira de Melo, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights and the highest-ranking UN official in the country. UN flags were lowered to half-mast in mourning of the casualties, and in New York, UN spokesperson Fred Eckert read this statement from Secretary General Kofi Annan.
All of us at the United Nations are shocked and dismayed by today's attack, in which many of our colleagues have been injured and an unknown number have lost their lives, Iraqis as well as international staff. Nothing can excuse this act of unprovoked and murderous violence against men and women who went to Iraq for one purpose only, to help the Iraqi people recover their independence and sovereignty, and to rebuild their country as fast as possible under leaders of their own choosing. I hope and pray that those injured will be swiftly brought to safety and be able to make a full recovery. I grieve deeply for those who have died and express my most heartfelt sympathy to their loved ones. I also hope to see those who have perpetrated this outrage brought to justice. Most of all, I hope to see Iraq restored as soon as possible to peace, security, and full independence. The United Nations will make every effort to bring that about.
UN spokesperson Fred Eckert reading a statement from Secretary General Kofi Annan, who's traveling in Northern Europe. Peace Watch spoke earlier today with Cameron Barr, Mideast correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, who visited the scene of the explosion.
Well, I got to the building and about an hour, maybe an hour and a half after the blast, which occurred at about 4:30 in the afternoon, Baghdad time. At that time, there was a little bit of smoke still rising from the bomb itself. The Americans were out in force in all kinds of vehicles, Humvees, Bradleys, and helicopters trying to control the scene. They were trying to get a cordon up around the area, turning cars away and turning people away as much as possible, but people were still filtering through. it wasn't, from where I was standing, there wasn't much visible of the parking lot where the, and the car that exploded. We could see that a corner of the building had pretty much been carved away by the blast. It's a three-story building. It's a former hotel that's been converted into offices. It's the headquarters mainly of the UN office here called the Humanitarian Coordinator. That's basically the guy who administers the UN's Oil for Food program, which is being phased out here because of the American presence. People here say 16 dead. I'm sure there are many dozens of people injured. It was 4:30, so it was sort of getting to be the end of the workday. There was still there was a press conference underway, and there were some very, very dramatic television pictures of that press conference taking place. And then the lights going out as the explosion hits, and then people sort of recovering from the impact of the blast, and many, many people in those pictures are wounded. But towards the end of our time at the scene, we could see some people leaving the building. Obviously, those who'd been treated with minor injuries, cuts and various things bandaged. You know, there was just a fair amount of speculation at the scene as to what had caused it. The sort of number one theory was that mm-hmm. it was a suicide bomber, a truck, a cement mixer that had driven along a side road next to the compound and then crashed through a wall. And that, there was one man today at the scene who said he witnessed this, and he witnessed the man not exiting the vehicle before the explosion. So that has led to the speculation that this was a suicide bombing.
Is this facility located in the central part of the city?
No, I would say it's sort of on the edge of the city. It's in the eastern part. As I said, it's a converted hotel. There's not much around it. I mean, it's not a built-up area.
Mm-hmm.
Directly in front of the area, there's a canal and a very wide median separating the road that fronts the compound with some more built-up areas across the median. So it has a kind of open feel, like many parts of Baghdad. You know, the color there is sort of a dun, very beige color, and there's a fair amount of palm trees around. And it's quite dusty because of this open field right in front of the building.
Is it somewhat isolated? It sounds like it may be somewhat isolated.
Yeah, you would describe it as sort of mixed-use industrial area, but there just happened to be this hotel there, and that was the UN's been in that building for many, many years. I don't know exactly when they occupied it, took it over, but they have conducted their operations out of that building. The inspectors were based primarily in that building, and then this humanitarian effort was based in the building as well. But there are other UN sites around Baghdad. The UNICEF is someplace else. Different UN functions are housed in different locations.
Is it your feeling, perhaps, that this building was perhaps targeted because of its sort of more isolated position?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I think it's pretty easy for folks with a lot of explosives to drive around town and blow things up.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Baghdad is a big city. It's impossible for the Americans to control every street corner. I think this building was hit because it's the headquarters.
You said a press conference was actually taking place at the time of the blast, and so I would imagine then that there is actual footage of this blast taking place?
Yes, I've seen the footage on BBC. There's a footage, it's a footage of a man speaking at a podium. The lights go out, and then there's the cameraman turns his own light on, because there's no power in the building after the blast, and you see the people in the room recovering from their injuries. But this was, I don't think it was a terribly well-attended press conference. It was about mine removal programs in the country being run by the UN.
Is there any speculation at this point, Cameron, about who might have been responsible for this attack or why the UN headquarters was targeted?
Well, I think it's fair to say that the UN is a mixed image here. I mean, the UN has, in effect, been responsible for feeding the country for the past, 6 years. The UN's Oil for Food program, which takes revenues from the sale of Iraqi oil and uses it to fund the provision of food and medical supplies and other humanitarian supplies, has, in a lot of ways, kept body and soul together for Iraqis during the embargo that preceded the war. Now, at the same time, the UN is associated with the inspections processes of the past decade or so, and that is very much identified with the United States. So you can spin it both ways. I mean, this could be, an attempt to create chaos, to simply demonstrate that the Americans cannot provide security, they are not providing security. You can read the UN as a symbol for the United States, as a stand-in for the United States, possibly a slightly easier target. I mean, this was a guarded facility. There was some U.S. military presence at the facility to protect it. But it was a more accessible target, I think, than, you know, any sort of American military headquarters here, or the headquarters, for instance, of the Coalition Provisional Authority, which is in one of Saddam Hussein's old palaces, which is ringed by a huge wall, is very vast, and is now surrounded by acres of concertina wire. I think it would be very hard for someone to get a truck bomb or a car bomb inside that facility. Whereas the UN facility is, as I said, it's simply a hotel that's been converted into office space. It's surrounded by a wall. There is security there, but this is not the kind of fortress that, you know, American embassies around the world have generally become.
Well, there have been several theories about whether these seeming ongoing attacks are caused by former Baathists and supporters of Saddam Hussein, whether they're caused by average Iraqis basically frustrated with the U.S. occupation of their country, or whether they are, in fact, the work of outsider terrorist groups or individuals who've come to Iraq to perhaps launch jihad against the U.S. forces. What is your analysis of what's going on?
Well, I'll tell you that options one and three that you just identified are the groups the Americans say are responsible for this violence. You know, I have not made a great study of this. I have, however, sat down with a gentleman who claimed, and I thought very convincing detail, to have participated in an attack on U.S. forces in early June. And this man is no Baathist. I mean, he was very articulate in his criticisms of the former regime. He had done military service, and he said it was like being in a jungle full of lions. And he meant that the officers, the sort of bribe-soliciting officers, were the lions, and was very, very tough on the enlisted men. So he was full of criticism of the old regime, and yet he had joined this effort. He joined an underground group that was, and may still be, orchestrating attacks against the U.S. He thought that the group had decided to take a pause in using violence against the Americans because the violence was working against them. In other words, he described the attack that he participated in, which was a failed assault. I mean, it was in that they were not able to successfully hit an American convoy. I'm sure the assault was very successful from the standpoint of those who were in the convoy. But he said the group thought it backfired because the Americans came back the next day, and then they interrogated all the people in the surrounding villages. And he said, we just made the occupation worse for them than it had been before. He would be in your second category. In other words, ordinary Iraqis who were simply frustrated with the occupation and who want the Americans to leave and who think that violence is an effective way to communicate that message.
That was my question. And so do you think there's any connection between the attack today on the UN headquarters and the attack earlier this week on the oil pipeline?
Look, one can't say for sure, but these things don't happen in a vacuum. We are in this very transitional period here. Iraqis don't feel like the country is in their own hands at the moment. I think that generates a lot of frustration. There's a lot of frustration about what Iraqis call the unfulfilled promises of the Americans, in that there's no stability, there's no security. If there is a promise of democracy, I don't think a lot of people are believing it right now. But it has to be said that these people, in a way, they don't know what they're looking for. Most Iraqis have grown up under the Baath regime. They have no notion of what democracy would look like and sound like if they met it on the street. So in a way, they're awaiting something they can't describe, but they know it isn't here yet. So it's a very inchoate situation where, people are frustrated. And I think, there's enough resentment on purely sort of pride and nationalistic sovereignty terms to fuel a resistance movement, and I think that resistance movement is taking all kinds of shapes and sizes. These attacks on, civilian or soft targets in Baghdad, pipelines, oil pipelines. I mean, there was an attack within the past few days against the infamous Abu Ghraib prison in Baghdad, which, of course, Saddam emptied in October, which is now under the control of the Americans. It's where the Americans keep people that they believe are involved in the resistance, in the organized attacks. And this facility was hit by three mortars, and six Iraqis died. So, if there is a lot of organization here, I mean, it's very difficult to discern exactly what the program is.
We were noticing that there seems to be a shift away from targeting the actual soldiers, the U.S. and allied troops and forces. onto the facilities and the structures, the prison, the pipeline, today the UN headquarters.
Yeah.
And so
I think that may mainly be an error of perception. I mean, the attacks on soldiers are persisting. I mean, there was a 1st Armored Division guy who was killed 2 nights ago. I think the rate, we may be ebbing a little bit, but it's still happening on a daily or an every other day basis that that an American soldier dies as a result of a hostile attack here in Iraq. Mm. I mean, there was they don't have to be Americans either. A Dane was killed a couple of days ago.
Mm.
So, you know, this is going on. It's not as much of a story as it used to be. These other things are more the story. But the backdrop of attacks on the coalition itself, on the American forces themselves, are continuing.
Cameron Barr is a Mideast correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. We reached him in Baghdad. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. It's your financial support that makes this show possible. So if you find yourself being informed in a unique way, we urge you to make a generous donation through our secure online website at www.pacifica.org. That's www.pacifica.org. Well, many analysts have said that the continuing failure of U.S. forces to fully restore public services in Iraq, as well as a series of mishaps where soldiers have inadvertently killed unarmed civilians, have helped fuel the flames of anti-American sentiment. One such incident occurred earlier this month when panicking U.S. troops opened fire on a car trying to make it home before curfew. Robert Knight of Pacifica Station WBAI in New York spoke earlier today with Quiva Butterly, a volunteer with Voices in the Wilderness and the Iraq Occupation Watch, who just completed conducting an investigation into that incident.
On August the 7th, there were two separate cars that were traveling down a dark road. You know, there's been frequent power cuts in Baghdad. The electricity fluctuates greatly, and it's quite ironic to see, you know, Bush calling it a state of national emergency in the States when people are without electricity for 5 hours. It's been going on for 5 months here. The road was dark. Three young men, one called Faith, the other Ali Hussein Ali, and another Abbas, who was 18 years old, were traveling down a dark road back to their own home in Hayat al-Tunis in the Salah suburb of Baghdad. Apparently at this time, about 20 minutes earlier, American occupation forces had begun to search and raid a shop in the neighborhood. In that process, witnesses have stated that the owner of the shop was quite badly beaten when he refused to open his shop for the troops. Troops were on foot around the area, but apparently did not have the lights of their vehicles turned on. As the first car carrying the three young men approached the U.S. military vehicle, apparently warning shots were fired out. The car stopped, and this has been stated by all witnesses present in the houses around the area, and the three young men remained in the car. At this stage, a second car containing a family of six, among them an 8-year-old child, a 17-year-old girl, 18-year-old boy, and 13-year-old girl, and their parents, including their 9-month heavily pregnant mother, approached the same street. At this stage, somewhere between 9:30 and 9:35, apparently American troops started to fire upon the two cars. Over 40 bullets were shot into both cars in a period of about 15 minutes, wounding initially the 21-year-old driver, Faith, of the first car. Eyewitnesses then report seeing a soldier coming on foot towards the car with a grenade launcher attached to his gun and firing directly into the car. A few minutes before this happened, the two occupants of the back seat of the car, who apparently had been lightly wounded in their shoulders by bullets, jumped out of the car. The car was fired upon. It went up in flames. Safe body was incinerated. The two guys who had jumped out the back seat, according to a guy called Abu Ali Hekmet, who is the father of another guy who was killed around the same time, said the two young men were then taken. Soldiers put their boots on their heads, were handcuffed and hooded, and then arrested. During this time, when they had been firing at the first car, over 20 bullets also struck the second car, entering through mainly the windshield and the chassis. During this time, a 42-year-old father of a family and his 17-year-old daughter, 18-year-old son, and 8-year-old daughter were all wounded. 17-year-old and 18-year-old apparently died almost immediately. The father and the 8-year-old girl did not. They were both quite severely wounded, according to their mother, a woman called Anwar, who then fled the scene trying to get help. Her other daughter, a girl called Hadil, who was 13 years old, was quite badly wounded by shrapnel as she struggled out of the car, testifies that an American soldier, a woman, came up to her and quite badly treated her, covered in bruises when we interviewed her. At this stage, apparently a military ambulance took the father and the 8-year-old girl, Mervit, into the custody and took them away from the area. They were taken to a hospital called Medical City. However, they were taken away before 10 o'clock and they didn't arrive at the hospital until 11 o'clock. It's about a 10-minute ride from the scene of where this, all of this happened. So there's a lot of speculation, you know, why the time delay, obviously. And one doctor is reported as having told the family that had they been taken to hospital immediately, they might have been able to save them. But what, as it was, they died within 15 minutes of being admitted from their wounds and from heavy blood loss. During the proceedings, when both of these cars were being fired upon, apparently neighbors from the surrounding area came out of their homes and tried to help people. As the car was burning, apparently the 21-year-old man, safe, was still alive, and people report hearing his screams for help. People tried to help him, but were shot at by US soldiers. Five other people from the neighborhood were wounded in the process, and apparently the shooting was so erratic that two U.S. soldiers were also wounded by U.S. bullets. People in the neighborhood stressed repeatedly that at no stage U.S. soldiers were under fire, that there was an excessive use of force used, you know, and the consequence of this is tragedy, that families have lost their loved ones. And tomorrow there's a press conference in which the families are calling for an independent, transparent, international investigation into what they're claiming is a war crime. Their demands, you know, are for this investigation, for accountability, that the soldiers responsible for it be brought to justice, for compensation and for a meeting with UPA officials. In our experience over the past few days of trying to get public, official comment on this from the occupational administration, it's been sort of quite discouraging, and therefore we're not really sure if the press conference will have that much impact upon them disclosing the results of what apparently took place, an internal investigation. There is thought that there is possibly a cover-up going on because the captain of the 1st Brigade, 1st Division, whose military base one presumes the soldiers who were responsible for the killings come from, was reportedly at the scene as this was going on. There's a man in the neighborhood who has positively identified him, only one man thus far, who recognized him from when he was signing some sort of document for him the week before. He claims that he saw Muscular at the site. When we went to visit the head of the base, Muscular, Captain John Muscular, he was quite nervous, and he didn't answer our questions. I mean, we can't, it's speculation at this point. But what isn't speculation is that there was use of excessive force and that, you know, there were gross human rights violations. And what isn't speculation is that this is happening on a regular basis. That as the sense of unaccountability and impunity grows, that this is going to become more of a common occurrence. And that's really, you know, what the families are trying to press for. They realize that they cannot bring back their loved ones. But what the mother, who fluctuates, I think, between a certain sort of composedness and just wild, inconsolable grief, but what she keeps on repeating is that maybe, you know, she can prevent another mother or another wife from having to walk on with this pain. There has been a precedent to this with five other people shot dead in Mansour a couple of weeks ago, and they were offered compensation of $1,500 each, which seems to be the going rate for an Iraqi life, you know, if compensation is given at this stage.
Has there been any interest or impediment to the investigation by United States military or intelligence authorities?
Not yet. We're expecting it. I think just because of the nature of perhaps, you know, at least, you know, fairly high-ranking soldiers, possibly a captain being involved in this. We've received, you know, in other sort of work here, in sort of solidarity activism and in accompaniment, in trying to support, you know, a non-violent civil resistance movement here, quite a bit of personal intimidation. You know, we've been told that we'll be deported or arrested. A friend had a gun held up to his chest by a U.S. an American soldier a few days ago and was told, you know, accidents happen in this part of the world. We're expecting it because I don't think it's a precedent that the administration here is prepared really to accept, because if they were to do so, you know, the flouting continual breaches of international law that have happened, you know, both in the lead-up, the prelude, and during the war, and certainly afterwards as well, would be under further scrutiny. Our fears, you know, obviously lie more in terms of the families that we're trying to support in this welfare. But we are, you know, spending nights with them. We're staying in their houses at night and just trying to keep them as safe as possible within this. I think that they are frightened, but they're also very determined. They're saying that they've lived through a lot. You know, they've lived through not only, you know, the regime, but 12 years of genocidal sanctions and continual bombing campaigns. You know, they've lived through, you know, the most horrific tragedy that one could ever, you know, imagine could happen to a family. They can live through a period of intimidation. And I think in some ways, if the media picks up on this, if the profile is raised a bit, that that will be a protection mechanism unto itself.
You said this was representative of a number of incidents occurring in occupied Iraq. Is this typical or anomalous, and what effect is it having on the behavior of people in the occupation?
It's not every day. We've heard of incidents like this every few days of live ammunition being used as a form of crowd control in demonstrations in Fallujah, Mosul, most notably, of unarmed civilians being shot dead at checkpoints because they misunderstand the instructions or are given no warning before, particularly U.S. soldiers, less so British, surprisingly enough, but open fire on civilian cars. It's as the violence and hostility of this occupation is increasing, the reaction to it, you know, the violence and hostility of the reaction of Iraqis is growing. They're not winning friends here, you know, certainly not hearts or minds, and let alone trust. I think people, you know, were prepared. A lot of people that I know here after the war were hoping against hope, you know, that perhaps for once in a very long time, the sanctity of their life, you know, the value of their blood, their human rights, a bid for genuine self-determination and sovereignty would finally be respected. I think that people, you know, given the occurrences of the last few months, given the rising sense of impunity, given the racism that is exhibited towards them on a daily basis, particularly by U.S. soldiers, you know, are seeing perhaps, you know, that these human rights will not be respected anymore now than they were in the past. And at this stage, you know, that they're being collectively plunged into another chapter of uncertainty and insecurity is very devastating for people. You know, there's no closing, there's no closure, there's no writing of the history, you know, which is rightfully theirs. People are just being kept, I think, in a permanent state of limbo, you know, really just forced upon them to see an alternative route of resistance. And that's, you know, that's very sad to see, because there's great potential here, I think, in, you know, the incredible resilience of people, that they can live through so much and still continue to organize. But it's a very difficult period for people, and I think it's accentuated by the heat, accentuated, you know, by the fact that there doesn't seem to be an end in sight for the time being. But there is, you know, against the backdrop of a lot of violence and increasing, you know, rate of crime. I think it's some hope. You know, there's a lot of on-the-ground grassroots organizing going on. There's the Union of the Unemployed, which has held a 19-day sit-in outside Bremer's residence in demand for provisional social security benefits of $100 a month for family and jobs. And if it continues to be, you know, almost solely armed resistance, I think that Iraq is going to be plunged into a cycle of violence, you know, which will be very, very difficult to extricate itself from. And sometimes I wonder, you know, whether that's a deliberate policy on behalf of U.S. foreign policy to keep Iraq in a state of permanent chaos and instability, you know, to justify a further prolonged occupational presence here, or whether it's just lack of planning.
Quiva Butterly is a volunteer with Voices in the Wilderness and the Iraq Occupation Watch. She spoke with Robert Knight of Pacifica Station WBAI in New York.
Hi, this is Scott Gurian, the producer of Peace Watch. If you're enjoying listening to this show, I urge you to take a moment and make a donation to ensure that this program continues. You can make a secure online pledge by visiting our website at www.pacifica.org. That's www.pacifica.org. Or send us a tax-deductible check or money order to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. And note that it's a donation for Peace Watch. Thanks for listening, and thanks for your support.
You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.